This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan and Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum, basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan & Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com.
You're listening to the Pennsylvania Woodsman, powered by Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network.
This show is driven to provide relatable hunting and outdoor content in the Keystone State and surrounding Northeast.
On this show, you'll hear an array of perspectives from biologists and industry professionals
to average Joes with a lifetime of knowledge.
All centered around values aiming to be better outdoorsmen and women,
both in the field as well as home and daily life.
No clicks, no self-interest. Just the light in the pursuit of creation.
And now, your host,
the pride of Pennsylvania,
the man who shoots straight and won't steer you wrong,
Johnny Appleseed himself,
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Pennsylvania Woodsman Podcast. Coming off of the Father's Day weekend, I had quite the Father's Day experience, let me tell you. So my oldest son, he just finished up his first year of T-ball, and it's been really fun. Like, I was really on the let's not start the whole baseball T-ball thing quite yet. You know, he's 6 years old. This is his first season, and maybe I'm just like my dad in this respect, but I just always felt like it was too early at that age to get kids out and doing baseball. It was just like kind of, you know, organized babysitting and just structured, and they weren't learning anything. But I was kind of wrong in that. And even though it was quite comical to watch and there wasn't a whole lot of baseball, it was still good to see him excel and stuff. And he did really well. I mean, he swings the bat real well, throws the ball decent. And, you know, season just ended. And on Saturday, he says to me, he's like, "Dad, can we play outside? Let's play baseball." He goes, "I want to practice." Well, I'm all for that. So let's go out, bud. And, you know, anytime that it comes from him, it gives dad an opportunity to help him. You know, of course, if he's doing something in a game or at practice and I want to correct him or help him, he's not on board with that. But if he asks, can we do something, he's got the ears to listen. So that's my opportunity to help him. So I was working with him in batting to practice taking a small step. You know, I remember when we were learning as kids, you know, a four-step process of step with your left, you know, as a right-handed batter, step with your front foot, pivot your back foot, you know, bring your body into contact and follow through. And he was just kind of swinging with his arms. I mean, hits the ball a ton with his arms for a kid, but I wanted to see him improve that. And I was, you know, he couldn't get the concept of how far to step. So I was trying to think of how do I get him to take this small few inch step. So I got the brilliant idea, as he's standing there in the batter's box, I'm going to stand in front of him facing the exact same direction. So picture somebody standing with their, ball bat up to the plate. They got their stance over the home plate. And then imagine somebody stands directly in front of you in the exact same way facing the pitcher. That's how I was standing to him. And I just wanted him to step into my back foot. So he was set up and he was going to take, you know, a 4-inch step to load. And that's all I wanted him to do. Practice going back, forth, back, forth. And I said, don't swing. And the first couple times he stepped, And he did great. And one of the times, he got the brilliant idea that he was going to step and take a full-on practice swing while I was standing there. And he did not hit me in the arm. He did not hit me in the leg. He did not hit me anywhere that would have been less painful. He hit me square between the legs. I mean, directly. There was no deflection. There was no hitting a thigh, pelvis, or anything before. It hit right in the family jewels. Directly. I dropped instantaneously. I mean, I've never felt that level of pain. I mean, I've gotten hit there playing sports plenty of times, but this was a direct hit from a metal bat, and I am still in a ton of pain. A ton of pain. And I felt so bad for him because I screamed, and I didn't scream at him. I just screamed in pain, fall, and then I was fall down to the ground, and I'm almost in tears, and he was scared, and I'm like trying my best to like, buddy, it's okay. Like, I'm not mad at you. It's okay. Even though I was like just, you can imagine. So that was my big Father's Day experience. But you know what? It was also pretty funny this weekend. You know, he kind of lightened up, and at one point on Sunday, he gave me a Father's Day card, and they gave me a gift. And, you know, he was all proud. He wrote a note in it, and I forget what it said, but it was all good. And I just gave him a hug. I said, thanks, bud. I said, I feel like the luckiest dad in the world. And he got a big smile on his face and was happy. And then I whispered to him, even if you still hit me in the nuts with a baseball bat. And he laughed. So apparently he got a sense of humor and thought that was funny. He goes, I'm sorry, Dad. I won't do it again. It's like, God, I hope not, kid. So wherever you happen to find yourself this past week or two, I hope that you had some good family time, some good fun stuff happening. You know, this week's been pretty busy. A lot of weeks here have been. There's a lot of moving parts, and I'm just going to blame getting hit on the nuts and the way this week's episode came in. So I decided this week we are going to have an episode from the archives. I've never done this, so we're going to resurface an episode we did about 2 years ago, and we haven't done a food plot episode yet for 2026. And I decided that I was going to go through and choose one that I'm not going to say it was my favorite episode I ever did. I've told you before, I've done a lot of episodes and enjoyed a lot of guests, and it's really, really hard to pick one out that's solely the best, and I refuse to do that. But I will say this one, I could definitely say I would put in the top four episodes as far as enjoyable episodes that I've done. And it's a food plot episode, and I'm going to leave it at that. Our guest is, it was a special guest, somebody I've looked up to over the years as a wildlife professional and biologist, and, you know, somebody who helps a lot of people, and we're going to let it at that. So please, before we listen to this episode, take a moment to check out the sponsors of this show. Radix Hunting, makers of awesome hunting gears from trail cameras, blinds, tree stands, feeders, and more. Check out radixhunting.com. Huntworth Gear, check it out. They got some crazy deals. They had deals up to 75% off. Huntworthgear.com. Huntworth is making a ton of awesome apparel. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Their price points are probably 50% of their competition, but the quality of the stuff that I've used from them and my level of comfort and enjoyment hunting is in the 90th percentile. I mean, it is good stuff. I love the camo patterns, love the mobility feel. Please check out the gear at huntworthgear.com. And also Little Mountain Outfitters. Little Mountain Outfitters, located in Richland, Pennsylvania, is the one-stop archery shop for all your bow hunting needs. And you can support them, and you can also purchase whatever you wish from their website at littlemountainoutfitters.com. And if you use the code Woodsman10, you'll save 10% off of your next purchase. All right, guys, with that, we are going to go back to the archives, as I said, and we are going to have a conversation with I'm going to say one of my food plot and wildlife heroes. Have a great week, guys. So joining me today, I'm going to do my best to not get all giddy and excited because this is a special guest I'm really excited to have on with me this afternoon. Dr. Grant Woods, thank you for taking some time and chatting with us.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity. I look forward to it.
Yeah, you're a busy, busy guy, but one thing that's been really, really cool is I just love how you network with people, and you know, you're not afraid to share your wealth of knowledge and share whatever you've learned in creation and help people.
Well, I'm usually learning from other people. I like visiting because I like learning, so it's a good thing for me to do. A lot of people out there have a lot of knowledge and experience. I like learning from practitioners. Of course, I come from a university background, you know, and stats and research, but through my career, that's very valid. That's still awesome. But I've learned that oftentimes practitioners, maybe farmers or whatever, some of them are, you know, pushing the edge somewhere. They're trying something new. And after they've tried and kind of figured out, then oftentimes university go, man, let's see if that really works. And they run a test. Well, I kind of like being on that cutting edge. And if you've got, in this case, a farmer that's just growing great crops, a little bit more profitable, doesn't have as much soil erosion, whatever you're looking for, then why not visit with them and learn from someone that's actually doing it? I just really enjoy learning from practitioners.
And one thing that I want to emphasize here, because it's important to me on my channel, is your openness to expressing your belief in Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior and sharing that truth with people. I really appreciate that you bring that into your show for people to listen.
Amen. That's a core to everything I do. You know, a lot, some people say that it is a core. And real simply, when I was 6 years old, first grade, I had a little trap line, a little rabbit box trap line. Of course, I thought it was a big Yukon trapper out there, you know, and it was in Missouri cold, snowy right before Christmas break that year. And I'd heard at the barbershop somewhere, I wish I could remember where, but they were going to restock some deer in the county. There were no deer. I'd never seen a living deer. I think I'd seen one on Daniel Boone's show or something like that. And one morning early, I did my chores. I went out to quote unquote run my trap line, like three little box traps for rabbits. And I found a female fawn in one of our little farm fields that had been shot in the head. First deer I ever saw had been poached. And I mean, from that moment on, I couldn't imagine something as valuable as a deer being, you know, poached like that. So I really dislike poachers, lawbreakers, whatever, and just been fascinated with deer. Well, years later, I come to believe that I think God literally used that moment to make me super interested in deer, and whatever skills I have, maybe I can, you know, get someone's attention, a fellow hunter or something, and share Christ with them. And that's literally been the basis for my career and still is today. I like learning about creation and the creator's plan, which is a lot about the release process, right? Using less synthetic inputs, whatnot, to make his creation very productive. We're not making it. We're kind of restoring it. And I'll take one more thing down this rabbit hole. I'm not mad at anyone. You know, when the first pioneers come through and they're cutting trees and burning, do whatever, they were just surviving, right? Mm-hmm. And more recently, when they got, you know, gasoline powered engines and moldboard plows, they were trying to feed a growing nation. No one was trying to cause erosion. That probably wasn't even a word then. So I'm not mad. I'm never mad about the past. I think we can learn by studying past events and hopefully improve in the future. And that's what the release process is. Or in ag, it's called regenerative ag.
Wholeheartedly. And one thing I'd like to just make mention of before we go on to this next part, you were talking about, you know, the creator's will for our life and such. One thing that I've truly believed in, and there are those little moments that God uses, I think, to guide and direct us and give us just thoughts of advice. But, you know, the creator's will for our life is to love him and follow him. And it's amazing how, you know, there's an open book with the tools and interests that he have to use us to network with people and share that truth. And I just love what you've done through something with as deep of scientific research and hard work as you put into it. I just really appreciate that. But I wanted to kind of go down a rabbit hole. We're talking about food plots in a lot of our conversations. And of all the people that I come to my mind when I think of a journey in food plots, you know, you've done a really good job of documenting from the time you started growing Deer TV and the Proving Grounds to where you're at now. I mean, you're up over 700 episodes, and there's a ton of information packed into those episodes. But I'd really like to, invest in some time discussing the journey from the time that ground was cleared and no-till, because I remember watching some of them first episodes with a no-till drill and listening to the rocks go through that, and it just makes me cringe. Then to seeing where it where the proven grounds ended up in your soul, it's just a unique journey, and I'd love for you to walk us through with that based on how you ended up coming to the release process. But no-till drilling, is that you started off no-tilling, right?
I did. So Trace and I, my wife Trace and I, were living in South Carolina. We had 13 acres. I was all excited. And all along our driveway was a food plot. You know, that's what you saw. You pulled in our driveway as a food plot. And then you finally got to the house. You got to get your values right here, I guess. But anyway, I was at that time, I started a little company called Biologic, later sold it to the Mossy Oak Boys, still friends with them. And I was planting some test plots and, you know, just trying different things. I'd went to New Zealand and learned about brassicas and want to see if, you know, a deer in North America would eat them or not. So doing stuff, planting single species at a time, doing stuff. And I'd borrow my buddy's old Ford tractor and his 3-point plow and just plow that clay till he just couldn't, you know, it'd just be dust flying everywhere. Nope, one more pass would be good. And kind of noticed, you know, a loss of production and whatnot. And Trace and I had the opportunity. We found an old burnout cattle ranch here at the Proven Grounds. And to be honest, I've never worked a property in my 31-year career that had as many cattle skeletons where cattle just starved to death on the ranch. That's how poor it was and why we could afford it. It was very inexpensive land. It was nothing like today. It was rough. And one scratch food plot or two in, had no money and had, you know, got hold of a tractor somehow. And the county here, our local county, which is still a practice today, a lot of people can use, has a NRCS office. Most counties in America have an NRCS office. And a lot of those offices will rent no-till drills. It was part of a big government program long ago, and they vary a little bit around different states, but they're typically like some like $7 an acre or a minimum of $70, real inexpensive. Great asset, I think, for people to use. Now, there's some issues, right? You may not get to drill right when you want it because when it's proper planting time, everybody wants to drill, or it's broken from the last guy who didn't take care of it. But it was a great tool for us. So knocked some trees down, locust trees and cedar trees is what I had, locust trees and cedar trees, and rented this drill. And literally after removing those trees, there was no topsoil. This is the Ozark Mountains. It's known to be highly eroded. The county is Stone County. That's the name of the county, Stone County. And I literally, at the time, I'd annoy better. I was planting treated seed, had all kind of nasty fungicide stuff on there, but they'd be colored purple or orange. So you knew they were dangerous. A lot of people don't know. Those colors are a warning. And I would drill by going down a path, and I could see my seeds laying on top of rocks, so I know how to space over, because there was no dent in the rocks. It wasn't like I was making furrows in the ground. I would see the seed, and it rained, right? God blessed us, and it grew somehow. In hindsight, I don't know how, but it grew. And then I had no plow to plow it under, so the next time I planted, I just plant right through that, right? It wasn't, oh, I'm doing regenerative ag. That wasn't even a word back then, literally. It's just the tools I had at hand.
Right, you were using conventional ag purposes just with no-till. You were doing mostly monocultures and commercial fertilizer, herbicides, correct?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. Our local co-op here in Missouri is MFA, Missouri Farmers Association. It's Tennessee Farmers Co-op in Tennessee, and, you know, various different names throughout the nation. And I took a soil test sample, of course, and I went to my local MFA store and took that sample in there, and they said, okay, you need this fertilizer, and I paid for it. It was even expensive back then. They brought their truck out. My land's again really rough, and I'll never forget this. I stand on my porch just so excited. I'm fertilizing food plot, you know, I'm a big boy now. This is cool. And he made one pass and just drove out the driveway. He didn't even stop. Just drove out the driveway. And I chased the guy down literally and caught him right before he got the driveway, actually. And, hey, you know, you have a flat, or, you know, what's wrong? I said, oh, your land's too rough, man. I'm not wasting my time fertilizing some little food plot, and drove out with the fertilizer I purchased in the back of his truck. I never forget it.
Wow.
And this was, again, a God point in my life, because, you know, of course, that was 21 years ago. I'm younger and ornerier and whatnot, and I get kind of upset. And so, by golly, I get my truck and drive down to Arkansas, which isn't that far from here, to an implement dealer, and I'm going to buy me a buggy spreader so I can spread my own fertilizer.
Right.
And I'm all fired up, and I go in there. We're still buddies today, actually, but this nice young Mennonite salesman, who was pretty calm, and he could just tell I was, you know, man, I was fighting mad, you know. And he's like, no, calm down, Mr. Woods. calm down. There may be a solution besides buying it. I wanted an Atom stainless steel fertilizer buggy. They're like the, you know, the best of the best fertilizer buggies right. at the time anyway. And he's like, now calm down, Mr. Woods. My uncle Galen just down the road here, he's kind of crazy. He'll drive anywhere and he makes composted turkey litter. And I'd heard about compost in college, but you know, back then you were taking your garbage out and putting some sawdust with it in the backyard, turning it like, oh, you know, I'm trying to grow big deer here. I need some NPK. He's mm-hmm. like, well, you just might want to visit with Uncle Galen before you do anything. Well, long story short, I did go visit with Uncle Galen, who was not being mean. You know, he had the beard and suspender overalls, kind of worn out, you know, and Uncle Galen was a genius, literally goes all over the world now teaching in compost and soil microbes. And to be honest, at that time, I didn't understand soil microbes. I was just like, well, this is cheaper than fertilizer, and he's willing to drive my heels. Put some on there, buddy. That's what I was thinking. But through the years, I worked with Galen for many years. He finally sold his recipe and stuff to a guy further away, and it was just too cost prohibitive to ship it here. It was a great product. It was just cost prohibitive, or become that way. And Galen taught me a lot about NPK. God never did the plants just take that out of the soil. They go through microbes. Microbes actually go in and out of roots, and, you know, it's really fascinating science. And Galen's the guy that got me thinking this. Never been to college in his life. Here I am just, I don't mean this wrong, but, you know, fresh PhD and got the world by the tail. And this farmer just taught me, again, a practitioner, just really took me to school. And he'd studied all over with kind of like a kung fu student with some masters of composting. And so that got me thinking, hey, there might be a different way than paying for this NPK. And it's, of course, it's synthetic made nitrogen. Was part of the process how to build the atomic bomb in Germany. Mm-hmm. And when the war was over and we won, that scientist came to America. You can go online and read all about this. And they said, well, I got this process, but I don't know what to do with it. And they said, well, we think we can use nitrogen for agriculture. Back then it was really cheap. Everyone applied way too much, kind of some of the problems we have today related to that. But so Galen took me under the wing. And as I started getting into that cycle, that circle of it, he introduced me to some buddies and we started talking microbes and soil, and then I started planting blends. I never thought about, well, who would plant, you know, a clover and a radish together, or what, you know, simple blends back then.
Yeah, was that just something you wanted to try, or like how did you start doing that? Because, you know, there was a time that was taboo.
Oh yeah, I got called a lot of nasty stuff back in the day. You know, I started thinking basically with clover. Clover used to be really strong, still is, of course. But clover in areas like this that traditionally go through a kind of a dry summer, shallow soils don't hold much moisture. Your clover brown up, might leave you with nothing but weeds for a few months out of the year, right? Or when it gets really cold, it goes dormant. And man, I need to fill that gap somehow. And so, and even some farmers back then, they were planting wheat as a cover crop with clover. And then I kind of discovered cereal rye, which grows more cold, hardy days. So I put some wheat, which is slightly more palatable in the warm season. And then when it gets really cold, the rye is more palatable. So I'm like, man, I can do clover, wheat, and rye and cover some more bases. And then I'm like, well, boy, when radishes first pop out of the ground, they're really palatable. So I could do a few radishes, some clover, wheat, and rye. And it just grew from there. And now I'm working on a summer blend right now. I think it's got 14 species in it. It's experimental for me. I'm going to have failures. I know that. I like seeing, because once you get into it, you learn some plants complement each other. For example, buckwheat, all plants leak carbonic acid. It's called exudates. And it just a little bit comes, they make more than they need. It comes out of roots, and you get that through photosynthesis, right? C6 carbon, H12O6, a byproduct of photosynthesis is a lot of carbon. And a little bit aside, we hear all this, oh, we got all this carbon in air, carbon's a pollutant, carbon. That's not my world of science. I'm not arguing that one or another, but I do know this. Carbon is the most important food for plants, bar none, over NPK or anything else. Plants are about 70% carbon. They're a small percent nitrogen. Carbon, if we have a problem, we need more carbon in soil. When you drive by in the South, you know, it's all red from iron oxidates or real gray clay or real yellow clay. That's a lack of carbon. Carbon makes soil black. Carbon's black. You've probably seen carbon before.
Sure.
Carbon makes soil black. And so our farming practices have pushed carbon up in the air instead of pumping it back in the soil. And so by planting more species together and getting these different strengths of carbonic acid, because our nutrients come from the parent material, i.e. rocky stuff, And another lesson, of course, I was taught in college in soil classes, it takes about 1,000 years to make an inch of soil. And you know how it is. The professor says it, you memorize it to pass the test, you believe it. And Galen's like, I'm going to build about 1/4 inch a year if you want me to. And I'm like, it takes 1,000,000 years, Galen, you can't do that. But
you're right.
By not disking the soil and the plants just pumping into it, I average about 1/4 inch a year here, have been for several years. And on those rocks where I started, I have many inches of really black, really super healthy soil organic matter.
It's incredible when you when I go back and I look at those first videos of you no-tilling to now, and I'm thinking of the videos, it was some of the ones you put last spring with Ward Labs, and seeing the how to soil test and going through that soil test. When I watched the video, and guys, if you've listened, if you're listening, you don't know what I'm talking about. There's a specific video about 9 months ago going through a soil test on the Proving Grounds, and I was absolutely astounded at the values on those, from your macronutrients to your micronutrients into the soil health aspect, which is another interesting topic of soil testing that we haven't really talked about here, and maybe we can get into that. But what's so fascinating is, correct me if I'm wrong, but there hasn't been a lot of fertilizer on that specific field of any form other than the release process for quite a long time.
Yeah, we haven't purchased any fertilizer or any lime or no magic juice in a jug or whatever for 8 years, except, and I want to always tell the truth, literally, I have bought a few bags of fertilizer, pelletized lime, and I'll do a little corner of a field or something as a test, mm-hmm. you know, to take a soil sample there versus over here, whatever. But that's a huge cost savings to not be buying, especially in the current market today. Fertilizer prices are, you know, double what they were last year, and last year's really high. And it's also time, right? I don't have to take the time to go buy that and spread it by hand in my small plots. So I've not bought any. Hear me clearly, folks. Not like fudging a little bit. I apply none. No compost. You know, there's not a workaround here. Always kind of work around on us. There's no workaround. I use plants and a good rotation, and I never disturb soil. I just follow the basic principles of soil health. Again, going back to the creator. And to tie into that, when I got going, I started thinking about, well, gosh, all the historians think there was about 60 million bison, I call them buffalo, on the Great Plains. That's an estimate, you know, give or take 10 million, who knows? A bunch of them, right? Big bison, big plains bison, not woodland bison over east, were about twice as big as the average cow now. So 120 cows, 120 million. There's not 120 million cows in the Great Plains now with all the synthetic fertilizer, lime, herbicide. Now, a lot more development, not as much land, all that stuff. But this was happening under God's plan with fire. Fire was, you know, wildfire, Native American set fire, you know, accidental fires, whatever. And buffaloes grazing. And I was in Yellowstone, family vacation. I was working out there a little bit as a naturalist, and then took a week for the family and I to go play tourist and whatnot. And we happened to be watching a herd of buffalo in Yellowstone crossing the Yellowstone River, and there was some little calves, and my daughter was worried about them getting swept down the river, you know, little family story. And I was thinking about, well, the goal, because I've worked in Yellowstone, the goal is 500 head of buffalo in Yellowstone. There's 6,000. Government won't kill them. You know, it's a bad thing. They're eating us out of house and home. And by the way, one of my pet peeves, we say our national parks are natural ecosystems. You know, in Yellowstone now, we got wolves and wolverines and cougars, you know, all stuff. But there used to be a sign at the South Gate said Yellowstone was a home to 30,000 Native Americans. Well, that's the most dominant predator, not grizzly bears, Native Americans. So Yellowstone's not natural until we allow hunting in there again.
Bingo.
You know that, because the elk stare at you.
Yeah, they do, ridiculously.
If you had a bow or 30-06 in your hand, they'd be going the other way, buddy. Just a few shots, they figured that one out quick. So they've allowed that to be, the vegetation to be extremely over-browsed, because it's not managed as it was set up for that ecosystem. Too many critters out there. And unfortunately, a lot of deer herds across America are the same way. There's more mouths than groceries, because... And a real simple thing for your listeners to do, I make all my interns do this. Some of them don't like it, but I still, you know, I'll sit in the truck with them, make them do it. But you can go to YouTube and just search for Daniel Boone's biography. Daniel Boone was very literate, wrote a lot. He didn't spell much better than I do, but he wrote a lot. And he talks about going all the way across Kentucky, and he's wide open, just, you know, a tree every 100 yards and grass and forbs in between. Uncountable turkeys. He wrote one place, he heard a turkey gobble from east to west. He was never out of hearing range of a turkey gobbling as he crossed Kentucky. Now turkey populations are plummeting, right? Mm. And more recently, a brilliant researcher for the Forest Service, United States Forest Service. And that's very political. I got a lot of buddies work there. I'm just telling, it's just political. Wrote a true scientific paper, said, we don't have an issue with too many deer. We have an issue with unnatural, low-quality habitat.
Mm.
And that's true because throughout most of America, we have a closed canopy forest. But every area, like in my area, there was an early explorer, I think like Lewis and Clark's at much smaller scale, a guy named Schoolcroft went through here looking for a lead mine. And this was when there were just a few trappers in the area. You know, he was seeing Native Americans and smelling Native American campfires and whatnot. It's only about 70 pages of notes. It was a shorter journey than Lewis and Clark. He just may swing through the Ozarks here. And he talks about these wide open oak savannas and grass as high as a horse's bridle. And he never mentions tick. Lewis and Clark never mentions tick because these areas were wide open and got more sunshine. Ticks need moisture like deep leaf litter. And there was a lot of fire, a lot of Native American set fire. And fire, of course, desiccates the grounds, and ticks have to have moisture. So the best, like any animal, we can improve the habitat and make more of a species or allow that species to propagate, which we've done for ticks, right? Thick leaf litter, right. No fire, perfect tick habitat. Or we could manage against ticks, open up that forest, let some more sunshine down, have grasses and forbs growing instead of leaf litter, burn it off every now and then.
All right, everyone, it's that time of year where things are greening up and I'm starting to think about food plots. And if you're doing the same thing, look no farther than Vitalize Seed, specifically Nitro Boost spring and summer planting. It's the food plot that has the ability to fix atmospheric nitrogen and add diversity to your food plot mix. It's highly browse tolerant and adds a ton of benefit, not just to the wildlife, but for your soil. 30% more diversity than any other food plot you're going to find, and it's engineered for the proper carbon to nitrogen ratio to naturally feed your soil biology and set you up for a fall food plot like no other. Diversity is king for your wildlife and for your soil. Look no farther and check out Vitalize Seed.
And research shows clearly that those tick populations, they're not going to wipe them out, but they will decline. The reason we don't wipe them out is when that turns green, it's the best food in the neighborhood. So deer come back in there, rabbits come in there, and they shed a few ticks.
Yeah, it's quite interesting that, you know, I have conversations with farmers all across Pennsylvania. And it's amazing how I have conversations with farmers that complain about the high densities of deer and extreme, defoliation in crop fields. And then in the same communities, we'll come have conversations with people in the public and hunters and managers that say we don't have enough deer, and the ideologies of kind of a social carrying capacity are quite different. And I've had this conversation with a lot of my growers and try to emphasize that, you know, one of the biggest problems is there's probably not as many deer across this landscape as you think there are that are, you know, defoliating your crops. But the one thing that I have noticed across the ridges and valleys in our state is the low quality habitat surrounding these crop fields that has forced a lot of browse pressure to occur on highly manicured croplands. You know, we got a lot of high quality fertilizers and manures and high quality soils that produce good corn, soybeans, wheat, and a host of other crops. And I think it's causing that much more stress on crop fields when it and in reality shouldn't. And that kind of stirs a question in my mind, going back to the release process and building soil and building fertility. I'm curious, you know, watching the Proving Grounds build to what it is today, there was a process that happened not just in your food plots, but on the landscape itself. And it was high-quality food and cover across the entire landscape, including food plots. So, you know, we're talking about having high-quality native browse and such, but do you find that because this is what I get. People ask me a lot, well, how do I implement a release system, a no-till system that's going to build my fertility and this and that? But I'm a lot of the time what I see is it doesn't seem like the amount of emphasis is put into the native habitat, and there's more pressure on food plots. I'm sure you've seen that in your travels across the country. So can you explain to us a little bit, like when people are listening to the release process, this no-till system, regenerative ag, whatever buzzwords we want to call it, Dr. Woods, what are some of the things that we need to watch out for to make this really, really work? Let's say it's a field that has really poor fertility, you know, something like when you started out and you're trying to build it. What are some of the things you need to watch out in order to make this success, and what should be the expectation when you're going into this journey?
I think you just hit the key word, expectations, and we know that satisfaction is a function of expectations. So if you carve out a quarter acre food plot on the side of one of those ridges in Pennsylvania, and for a mile in every direction it's closed canopy forest, you're going to track some deer as long as there's still forage there, but you're probably not going to make a lot of progress in improving the soil's health because your plants never get big enough. You know, we think about a plant like an iceberg. You see about one third above soil and there's two third of roots below the soil. Now, when you go to pull the plant out of soil, you don't see that, but you hear this because you're ripping off all the little hair roots or the biggest portion of biomass. They tend to stay in the soil, but, and I have that at my place. I can go to a more timbered portion of my property where I haven't done as much TSI or timber stand improvement yet and scratch out a little food plot by hand tools. I do it all the time for hunting. I call them hideos plant, and I won't get the tonnage per square foot or unit area as I do in a bigger field because there's so much pressure there because they're so close to cover. So ideally, the release process would be a combination of working on your native habitat and releasing its potential, which usually means opening up the canopy and suppressing or killing the low quality trees and leaving the better quality trees. Now, I'm a forester also by training. I have a degree in forestry too. And every time I say this, I get a bunch of hate mail from foresters. So please, let's just skip that step this time. Okay. I've had enough hate mail. You're not going to say anything. Someone had already called me fat, ugly, skinny, fat and skinny at the same time. I've already heard it all. So, but foresters are there to make a living. And so they want to naturally, and I understand, take the better trees because they get a better return for their effort, right? If you cut a big old cherry saw timber log, you're going to make more money at the mill than hardwood pulp, as a facetious example. So foresters often want to take the best and leave the rest. That's their economic model. Sometimes a landowner has a different objective, especially if they purchase land for recreation, maybe to hunt or scenic beauty or whatever. And they want to leave those best trees. And I think there's a very workable compromise. We need to realize, because oftentimes foresters say, and this is this rule of thumb I see across America, well, we're going to cut everything 18 inches or bigger, which tends to be the better trees, right? They grew better, straighter, and you leave the worst trees. You do that a couple of rotations on your property, you're left with junk wood. And it's decades to turn that around. So instead of just taking a harvest by diameter, which is really easy, tell the operator, hey, buddy, you know, Bob, if it's over 18 inches, put that thing on a truck and do it by species or take out all the crooked trees and you're going to make less profit, but now you're leaving the better trees. And so for recreational landowners, not production timberland, recreational landowners, we have to have a change of heart of forestry in most areas where we're doing true timber stand improvement, our harvest for commercial or profit or pre-commercial harvest. You're just out there hacking, squirting, working to improve the timber future value for you or your family and wildlife habitat at the same time. Because I won't take much time, but in simple terms, I'll use pine trees because they're so marketable and easy. If you've got a pine tree not big enough to make a 2x4, that would be sold as pulp, and that's a lower value per ton. And if you get into chip and saw, you can cut at least a 2x4 out of middle. Well, that's more valuable for the same volume wood chipped up because it has to be straight and a certain grain quality and whatnot. And if you get big enough to cut a 2x6, well, 2x6 is 1.5 2x4s. But if you go to Home Depot or wherever you go, a 2x6 is more than twice a 2x4 because it takes a bigger tree. You had to wait more years to even cut the 2x4. You know, on up, a 2x12 is a very expensive tree because you had to have a pretty big tree. So if the landowner can be patient and wait a little bit more, they don't need that money to pay their mortgage right then, they will make more money per year if you cost figure this over a period of years, by selling a better product and allowing their timber to improve where they can have a continual stream of better products over time. But unfortunately, that takes some thinking and some patience. So a lot of people just, hey, cut everything 16 inches or bigger. Mm. We've done that for a couple of rotations now throughout much of the Whitetail's range, and we have historically low quality forest, especially in our hardwoods, because they're not managed precisely as pines are often. So I'm encouraging recreational landowners to turn that trend and manage for better quality timber. And by doing so, you will have better deer habitat. You're going to give that tree more room around it, more sun to express its genetic potential. And more sun means you're getting some grasses and forbs, which give you cover and food. And you're taking out those low quality trees, because remember, growing deer is all about photosynthesis. We have to do photosynthesis to make grain or protein. Any of those things we consider feed all start with photosynthesis. None of that happens without photosynthesis. Cows don't gain weight. Bucks don't gain weight. Bucks don't grow antlers. Does don't have fawns without photosynthesis. If they're in a pen, they're hauling in feed that was created by photosynthesis somewhere else. It literally all starts with photosynthesis. But when we have trees, all the photosynthesis is happening, you know, pick a number, 40, 60, 80 feet above the ground. We have to have photosynthesis within about 0 to 3 or 4 feet of the ground to grow better deer. So circling back around, if you approach like I've done your native habitat, be it timber, grasslands or whatever, and food plots at the same time, you will make much faster gains because you're growing more tonnage and spreading the deer out a little bit. Now, with that said, one last thing, you plant a 1 acre soybean field, soybean or alfalfa, something really highly palatable, whatever you pick, in the middle of a mile of closed campy forest, you're not going to make much progress. It's just so much better. It's like, Grant, do you want ice cream or do you want Brussels sprouts? So I'm going to take the ice cream every time. And deer are going to take that really lush forage versus a bramble offside of here.
And you're going to compare that monoculture in a food plot the same way that you would compare a monoculture in conventional agriculture. We're trying to push maximum tonnage and maximum yield potential in that, and we're going to harvest a very great deal from that, and it's going to deprive a lot from that soil. So, you know, sticking with the release process, so with some of the fields, like the field that you would have had that soil test on, can you give us a snapshot of the timeline and the years of progress and how you saw the trends in your soil samples change and the tonnage, therefore, change in those food plots?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I started pretty much with soybeans, and deer, I'm 100 miles from any type of ag. Deer had never seen a soybean. There's no grain carts, no silos, no combines anywhere near me. You never see them on the highway or anything. There's none, zero. Hard for some people to imagine. So I planted Eagle Seed soybeans. I know the family well, good family. And man, they were getting 5 feet tall because I'd watch deer. They would walk through the soybeans and eat a ragweed on the side of the field. And it used to bug. I'm like, I spent all this money making this food plot, you know? And that happened about 2 years. And so I'm growing a lot of biomass that wasn't being consumed and recycling that in the soil and adding a little bit of compost as budget allowed. And then deer discovered soybeans. And I made a mistake. I hung with them too long, but the last few years I planted them, they never got lip high. And I'm spending quite a bit of resources, time, diesel fuel, whatever, plus seed. And I wasn't making progress. So I kind of went backwards a little bit. And I started planting some blends in the winter. Most people start with fall. It's easier, less weed competition or whatever. And I started planting blends, and man, all of a sudden my soil tests are getting a nudge better and I'm growing more tons. It's not lip high. You know, and in the spring when deer back off food plots and go to native vegetation because it greens up, my food plots are getting chin high on me. I'm 6 feet tall. You know, I'm walking through here getting pollen in my nose. And I started really adding tonnage. And about that time, I found a farmer named David Brandt. You can still go to YouTube, find him. Dave, I've never met David. He's a brilliant man. Love to shake his hand. And he's a production ag farmer, mainly on rented land. He doesn't own a lot of land in Ohio in an area where development's taken up most of the cropland. So it's real competitive to get land. And he went broke, and he sold all his equipment, and he bought a no-till drill, last ditch effort, and played with that for a few years, started making a little progress. And he got a roller crimper, so he's terminating with a crimper instead of a herbicide. And a herbicide, of course, is not natural. That's a toxin in soil. I'm not anti-herbicide, but I want people to use the least amount necessary. I relate herbicide like a root canal. I don't want one, but if I have to have one to save the tooth next to it, I'll certainly get one. Mm. And if you're full of really noxious weeds, you're probably not going to get on top of it with just a roller crimper. So you may have to use a pass or two of herbicide just kind of set the clock back. It's pretty simple stuff. And David Brandt went from these yucky, yucky baby poop colored yellow clay soils to right now, it has 22 inches of black dirt. Now he's been doing it longer than me and gets a little bit more rain. And it's so, he's changed his soil so much. And this is all published. There's no rumor here. That the he's one of two places in North America that the NRCS has went in and reclassified soil because on his side of fence, it is so different than the rest of the county.
Mm.
And he's making way more profit and putting less inputs in. And David got me started through his sharing his information on YouTube about roller crimping. So I scrounged around and got me a roller crimper and stopped using as much and now almost zero herbicide. And when I let crops get full maturity, okay, so the cereal grains, rye, wheat, whatever, you know, depending on the crop, the year and the rain, it's 4 to 6 feet tall, a lot of tons. And clover's just dog-ear thick because if you plant just grasses like small grains, some sun will get through there and hit soil. And I don't want to waste any sunshine. I want every bit of sunshine hitting the leaf. That's God's, the best solar reactor on the planet. Elon Musk will never make a solar panel as efficient as a leaf. It just can't be done. There's waste in chemical energy, right?
Right.
So God's got these beautifully efficient solar panels that make energy. And that energy transfers to the soil in the form of those carbon exudates, which feeds the bacteria, which converts rock to fertilizer. So I got a roller crimper, and now I'm growing tons of forage. It matures past where deer want to eat it. I let it get to the dough stage, so it's really not palatable. And when plants are making seeds that are fully formed but still moist, they're not viable yet, they're real weak, so crimping them just terminates it easy. And I would plant through this really tall stuff. I started crimping first and trying to plant through it. And it's so, you know, you got 4 inches of duff. You're almost no-till drill will cut through it. You're getting seed hung up in the vegetation. So again, David Brandt showed me, although he didn't know he showed me, hey, plant first and then crimp. That's called planting green. So I just tried it. I mean, no one, I don't think anyone in Missouri was doing it, let alone down here in the Ozarks. So I'm getting laughed at and, you know, poked fun at. You got to have a little thick skin to do this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I plant green. I mean, the beautiful thing about plant green, you never get lost, right? Either right. The vegetation's kind of laying down or you haven't planted there yet. You know if you've skipped anything. So I'm planting green. My radiator's getting full of pollen. You know, people are laughing at me. And then I crimp once the vegetation gets about 2 inches tall. And you're thinking, well, you're going to kill it. When you drive through your yard, you don't kill your grass, right? It stands back up in a day or two. Those young plants are so pliable. They just stand back up. So there's a lot of beauty here. We talked about overbrowsing. You've got 4 foot tall vegetation and a 2 inch tall, you know, brassica or buckwheat or sunflower or soybean, whatever it is. I have a mix of all of those. Deer can't find it because they don't stick their head down to 4 feet of vegetation to get there. So it's like a greenhouse. If it gets cold, it's keeping that cold from getting all the way to ground. Harsh rain's not pounding it. It's not splashing soil up on the leaves, which is how plants get bacteria. It takes all those issues away. I don't spend any money on fungicide at all. That's a total waste of time for me. And so now I got this little greenhouse protecting my plants while they're getting their root system so they can handle browse pressure better. And again, the release process is just working with creation, because if you think about the prairie, seeds would fall down. Maybe buffalo would come through and trample it, and they'd grow up in that duff. It was never bare ground. The ground was never bare.
Right.
So practitioners like David Brandt and many others, and looking at natural cycles is where the release process comes from.
Can you dig a little bit more into, so planting green, you already talked about it, so you're having a standing living crop that's present. You know, I do that a lot. I'm fortunate that my portion of the agriculture world in Pennsylvania here, we have a lot of that. It's really exciting to see that unfold. But I have personally run into some struggles when you're talking about putting cash crops into planting green and managing seeding rates and having really thick covers and sometimes having some residue management struggles. Have you had any of those struggles in your time messing with no-till and planting green into this release process?
Once I started planting green versus planting after I crimped, I haven't. But I think there's a couple of twists that really helped me. I wait a little later than a lot of people do, probably a week or two. I let my soil get really warm, and I make sure there's adequate moisture. So my seeds are just blowing out of the ground. I'll find some seeds that just maybe they hit a rock or whatever, and it didn't get into furrow very well. But it's protected by 4 inches of mulch. Well, that root finds the soil, and that baby's off to the races. And I don't have much weed competition because weed seeds, like no one's really ever seen a ragweed seed or a pigweed. They're so fine, they're like flour. I mean, if you shake it on your hand, you're seeing, but you don't see them blowing through the air. Well, those seeds have, all seeds have what I call onboard energy. And until they make leaves and photosynthesize, they don't get any more energy. Just putting a root in the ground doesn't really give me, you got to photosynthesize. So you've got your ground level. You've got 4 inches of pretty thick mulch from your past crop. You've crimped down. And you got a big old picket, sunflower, even buckwheat, you know, bean, pea, milo, whatever seed there. It's got quite a bit of onboard energy. And when I have enough energy for that seedling to weave through the duff and get up there and make two leaves and photosynthesize. But a ragweed, a pigweed, any of those really noxious weeds, sun hemp, or not sun hemp, water hemp, those seeds are so small, they tend to starve to death
right
before they get up and make a leaf and photosynthesize. So really inexpensive and pretty effective, not 100%, but pretty doggone effective weed control that just fits a natural system.
Absolutely.
So I haven't, but I'm disciplined to wait for my soil conditions to be right for my seeds to blow out of ground. If you plant some seeds, typically the softer shelled seeds, like a soybean or a pea or something soft, not hard like corn or clover, and they get kind of warm and kind of wet, they're going to germinate. And it's a real slow process, and that's more time for insects or fungus to attack them. I want my seeds blowing out of the ground, just blow past that stage. It's kind of like if we could magically snap our fingers and get turkey poults 1 month old, we'd have a lot higher survival rate because that first month they just get slaughtered. Well, if you plant a seed that's just growing really slow and weak, its chances of survival are pretty slim.
Yeah, I that's a really important point that you just brought up there. So a lot of people will talk about following the farmers and doing what the farmers, and that's good. But at the same time, you have to keep in mind that there's farmers out there that are farming hundreds, thousands of acres, and you got to keep in mind they got to start at some point when you're talking about having a window of planting. When we're talking about food plots, waiting for the optimum time is so important. Now, I know if you're renting a drill, you might have to, you know, be on, you know, on a waiting list, and maybe the optimum time doesn't happen. If you have your own drill, you know, you have that luxury of waiting like that. I want to circle back real quick. So we've talked about building soil, kind of seeing the fertility happen and the release process unfold. And we know it takes time. One part of that transition that's really, really hard for people to swallow, and you made mention of that, is weed pressure. And I talk about this with a lot of people. You know, there's what I would consider three main components of weed control, and that's chemical, that's culture, chemical, mechanical, and biological. So you know, mechanical, you'd be hand pulling, you know, tillage, forms like that, but that causes an array of problems, as we've already discussed. And the chemicals are a tool, but man, we've developed a system that has become so reliant on chemicals, and we don't put enough weight into that biological system. So I'm curious, you know, whether you want to use the proven grounds as your starting point, or maybe clients you've worked with across the country. Do you see any common trends or timelines as far as weed pressures and seeing this build and slowly deteriorating and managing that when you go to this system?
Yeah. One tip we mentioned just briefly earlier, there's tends to be less weed pressure of really noxious weeds if you plant in the fall going into winter.
Mm.
Summer is just full of a whole gamut of weeds. So if you got a big weed seed base, or, you know, you're taking over a weedy field, or maybe field got let go for some years, it may be better if you want to use no or very limited herbicides to start in the fall with a fall crop. It's just going to be less pressure. If you're going to start with a spring crop, you may want to use a Roundup Ready bean or something that's really a sunflower, something that's really readily accepting of certain herbicides to clean up that field. Now, we need to realize, and this research is out of Pennsylvania, actually Penn State, but on any square foot of soil a couple inches deep, so, you know, a foot by 2 inches deep, there are millions of weed seeds. And you think, I never seen a weed seed and I'm digging worms. Well, remember, these noxious weeds are so small you wouldn't see them. They're the same color as dirt. You're just not going to see them. But they're any dirt pile you see stacked up, like where they're building a new house, give it a little bit of time. There's weeds growing all over. It's just, you see it everywhere. The examples are omnipresent. So you may have to use a herbicide first year or two, even during that spring. A really good hint in your fall crop, you want to use something like cereal rye. I don't sell cereal rye. It's just it's a tool. It's one of many good tools. But it has a chemical substance in it, very similar to what walnut trees have. If you ever had a walnut tree in your yard, you notice the grass doesn't grow very well under it. And that's because that tree puts out a natural seed aside. It kills seeds. It kills competition, so it gets all the goody for itself. Cereal rye does that same thing. It's a big, long, fancy name, but it's not strong enough to, like, kill a clover seed or a corn seed. But those little small wee seeds, it does a good job of inhibiting. So I'm going to say a good thick stand of cereal rye. It's not spotty. Your blend had 30 or 40 pounds of cereal rye plus a bunch of other things. You're probably going to knock out 50% of your weeds right there. And that's a round number. A lot of context to your local environment. Mm-hmm. And then one thing I do, I like seeing a lot of deer. I run my deer pop, and I have really good habitat, so I can run a little bit higher in population. Okay? If you've got a lot of deer, maybe you're a smaller piece of land, your neighbors aren't harvesting does, for whatever reason you got a lot of deer, you need to realize that the manufacturer, the seed supplier put plant, I'm just going to use round numbers, 50 pounds per acre. And 50% of those are really attractive. Soybeans, you know, think of four or five species that are deer just going to eat as soon as they pop out of the ground.
Right.
Well, all of a sudden you got half a stand out there and you get all the sun hitting the ground and weeds are going to pop up. That's a given. So if you're planting a blend that has roughly half the seeds really palatable, you want to plant more than what they recommend. If they plant that they say 50 pounds and there's no magic number here, but consider 75 pounds. Seeds the cheapest thing we do have a food plot, right? You buy a tractor, you win a drill, you bought the land, you lease the land. Seeds should be the cheapest thing in your whole operation. So a few extra pounds of seed should not be a deal killer. If you're planting a monoculture of clover, adding more seed may not help you much. But if you're planting blends, realize that those most palatable species are going to be consumed before they mature, and there's going to be a gap that allows sundown. So I often plant 25 to 50% more than what's printed on the bag. And I try to plant. I'm like everyone else. I'm busy. I'm traveling. It's turkey season this spring. That's a big detractor for me. But I try to plant when soil conditions are ideal for those just to blow out of ground and get ahead of the deer. Because a lot of issues with weed pressure is just simply a lack of competition from the desired crop. So farmers learned long ago, if I go from planting 30-inch corn to 15-inch corn, I don't necessarily get a bigger yield. That's been shown, but I have less weed pressure. Some farmers now are being, because what drives corn production is photosynthesis. And I think this plays into wildlife, so I'm not going off the rabbit trail, but a lot of farmers are now planting, or not a lot, let's say 5% of farmers are planting 60-inch row corn, 5 feet apart. Same population. If they're planting, I'm going to use a round number, 20,000 kernels per acre in 15-inch rows, they're planting 20,000 kernels per acre, but in 5-foot rows. And those corn stalks are just, you know, they're side by side in a row. But when you go this way, instead of having a neighbor over 15 or 30 inches, you're getting full sunshine. And sunshine is what grows corn production. That's why the outside rows of corn usually produce more than the inside rows of corn, because they're not competing for sun. Mm-hmm. So a food plotter could plant 60-inch row corn and then plant a blend of, you know, goody stuff in the middle. The nitrogen off the goody stuff will feed the corn, cutting down on your fertilizer costs. You've got browse all summer and then a grain for the winter. And a lot of production, not a lot again, 5% or so of production farmers are really making massive improvements in their soil quality because they don't have that monoculture without giving up yield or their profit. They're actually becoming more profitable because they don't need the weed suppression and they don't need the fertilizer by doing that. So thinking out of the box, trying some different techniques. And again, that was a practitioner. The guy that first did that I read about was a retired engineer from John Deere that said, well, I've been building these machines all my life. I want to try farming, but I want to do the same thing. And that's where 60-inch row, as far as I can tell, that's where 60-inch corn come from, a practitioner being willing to try something different.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you brought up a lot of really, really great points there. losing my train of thought here because we got so many good topics here.
No, it's
great. I love this. I really love your enthusiasm over everything we're talking about because it's really important. I think food plots are one of those things that a lot of us have this mindset that there's one way to do it. There's one specific way. There's going to be the best food plot for this property, and that's the way it is. And I think the truth of the matter is that food plots, just like anything else, are an experiment. It's an ability to tinker and figure out what's going to work good in your landscape, in your soil, and this and that. The example I'd kind of like you to dive into real quick here is there's a misconception that with mixed blends, we talked about this earlier, that you certain species you can't mix. Now, you've obviously proved that with the blends that you've planted on the proving grounds. Just real quick, can you explain to people why that might be misguided information based on maybe seeding rates or something along those lines?
I think a lot of people start off saying you can't mix seed varieties because grandpa didn't do it. That's just common everywhere. And B, if you put them in your over-the-shoulder spin seeder, I mean, I've got a bunch of those I plant my little small food plots with all the time. Or you got a no-till drill or a cone seeder on the back of your tractor, whatever. You're thinking, well, I got to calibrate for one size seed. And I still hear that vicious rumor till today. And in all my years of planting blends, experimenting, helping landowners plant blends, whatever, I've had one example, because everyone says, well, the seed will separate by size. And you have, facetiously, a strip of corn and a strip of clover and a strip of turnips and a strip of okra, or whatever you got in there. I've never seen that. And I had it explained to me by, again, another farmer that this makes sense. I never knew why. I just knew I'd dump five bags of my drill and stir it up a little bit, take off. And I never ended up with just small, heavy seed like brassica on one end of the field. I've never seen that happen, ever. Mm-hmm. And I think different seeds, if you think about it, and you go to the garden store and get four or five different species of seed, put in your hand, they're obviously different shapes and sizes, but they're different textures. Beans are pretty smooth. A lot of combine, some people now plant beans and corn together and they separate them right in the combine, and the corn is hard and slick. So it goes down the cone faster and that shoots off into one bin, and the beans are round and slower and little rougher edge, and they shoot to another. That's the only separation process. So when you have that, it's almost like a strata of gravel in a creek bottom. You've got big and flat and rough, maybe a pumpkin seed. I plant viney plants in my food plots. And the advantage of a vine isn't necessarily, boy, deer love pumpkins, although they do. They don't eat the vines much. But that vine will seek. This is so cool. Again, this is God's plan. Mm. It will seek to find sunlight and make a big old pumpkin leaf. Well, guess what? If it's finding sunlight, weeds would have grew there unless that vine found it. That's the sole reason I put viney plants in my food plots, is just another simple, very inexpensive biological weed suppressor. Because you're going to have skips, your drill missed a lick, you hit a rock and it bounced and nothing grew. It happens to everyone, folks. And you said something earlier I want to say. Food plotters have a bit of a challenge because a farmer's got, a real expensive precision no-till drill. That baby could plant on the moon. We're out here with probably, not $100,000 drill planting food plots. We're out here with something a lot less. It's great quality equipment for our mission, but it's not a precision computer guided planting instrument that's driven by AI, artificial intelligence. That's not what I or most food plotters use. I got a bag out here walking, trying to trip on a rock or a stump. But that stratification. Now, in one time, it was last year, a good friend of mine, David Smith, has a pretty big food plot operation, a good drill in the mountains of Alabama. And David's a great farmer. He's taught himself through the years. I've learned a lot from David. And he started planting blends for the first time. I kept nudging him a little bit. He always planted monoculture soybeans and wheat or something like that. I started nudging on him. And he had a bigger drill than most food plotters do. David, when David gets into something, he's like really into it, So he had a big old really wide drill, and at the start of the morning, he's just dumping. I think he had like 20 bag seed or something. And he plants all day long, just going up fields, cross creek, whatever. He's just going. And at the end of the day, those last food plots, I'll have to say, were a little heavier brassicas. Those small hard seeds had settled and kind of stratified in there. Only time I've ever seen it in all my years. And with all the farmers, I worked with ag farmers too. All the farmers, I've never seen that happen. David had a unique experience, but I've been doing this for decades. Literally, I've never seen them stratify.
And I think another thing you hear people complain about is that you see competition between certain species. I know one thing I've heard, like you can never mix cereal grain with a brassica because they're going to compete with each other. And I think one thing that I would say is appropriate seeding rates are really important. You know, you work with great companies like Green Cover Seed that do a great job of making a blend that has appropriate seeding rates. Do you have any other thoughts to that?
Oh, I think you're exactly right. You know, depending on Nebraska, 2 to 4 pounds is enough to seed an acre as a monoculture. So I see these blends that got 5 pound Nebraskas and 40 pounds of cereal rye or, you know, whatever it is in there. Well, of course there's going to be competition. You're stacking them in there like ducks at a duck shoot, you know. So getting a blend appropriate, doesn't have to be perfect. This is not precision farming, but getting it in the right range. And again, I like strata. Okra gets real tall. Deer like okra, and it's a great soil builder. Sun hemp can get 7-8 feet tall, depending on where you're growing it, but not very broad foot. You know, it doesn't have much of a footprint. And the leaves on sun hemp are about the same as alfalfa. And the great thing about sun hemp, it's kind of a woody stem, right? You don't want a whole field of sun hemp, but it's just a good part of a summer blend. It's a woody stem, so deer don't eat the stem, so they don't kill it. And it keeps putting off new leaves on the side. So it's pretty browse resistant, not 100%, but pretty browse resistant, more than a bean or a pea or something. So again, an appropriate blend and a real hint is adding, you know, some pumpkins or watermelons or gourds or some vine plant. Cucumbers, if you got extra cucumber seed. And it's not about feeding the deer. And you're not wasting anything because what the deer don't consume just becomes slow release fertilizer for the next crop. You're never wasting when you're growing. And if it suppresses weeds and saves you, you know, pick a number, $20, $40, $50 an acre of herbicide, plus your Saturday, you know, plus wear and tear on your tractor and getting a flat tire because you ran over an antler. That's a big savings. So a few pounds of a viney crop can really help most summer food plot blends.
It adds up in the long run. Now, another thing I've had questioned with me, and I'm sure you've had this question many times, is a lot of people will say, well, planting 2 times a year, that gets expensive. And I just want to kind of focus the fall blend mostly on and not worry about the summer blend. There's some, from my point of view, there's some, you know, positives to that. But what's your general response to people when they make that comment?
You know, I'm fine if they want to do that, but I think you got to accept if you leave it dormant all summer, weeds are going to grow, right? Weeds are God does not like bare soil because, again, we need plants leaking carbon to feed the microbes. That's a given. That's not going to change from the Sahara to here. Literally, it's not going to change. So Nature Hates a Vacuum was published by a really famous scientist back in the 1800s, and that's still true to today. That was Voltaire, by the way. But, so if you're not planting a summer crop, weeds are going to grow, and you're going to disc or herbicide or something to control those weeds before you plant your fall crop. B, weeds tend to be more of a monoculture. I got all pokeweed or pokeweed, a little bit of ragweed or whatever. I want that good blend feeding those different microbes to give me free fertilizer for the soil. So I'm going to throw around number out of $50 an acre, $70 an acre, depending on what you're planting. To seed, then you got some labor, you know, however you calculate your time, diesel fuel, whatever. That's cheaper than buying fertilizer and herbicide 7 days out of the week. Those numbers are solid.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to plant a blend. I'm going to keep deer conditioned to feeding there. That's kind of our goal as deer hunters, right? I don't want my neighbor seeing them, I'm going to see them. That's just being honest. Sounds so selfish, and it is selfish. That's what we want to do.
Yeah.
So I'm going to keep them conditioned. I call that never cleaning the table. What really gets me is the guy's got a beautiful summer crop, man. I mean, it's, you know, magazine picture out there. And then about 4 weeks before deer season, he disc it up, which is the same as cleaning table. I shut the restaurant. We are closed here. We don't want to feed you. Please go feed on a neighbor's property.
Mm-hmm.
And wonders why his deer all left right before deer season. But if you plant green, you've got stuff growing, you plant through it. There's still stuff to eat. It's dying, but there's stuff to eat while the new crop is coming on. And that one tip has kept a lot of bucks home on a lot of properties.
I really like that. And we're getting close to a point where I'd like to wrap this up with you. I have one more question for food plots, and then I got two other questions, short answer questions that are, you know, completely different. But the last thing, you know, we all the whole conversation, we're talking about the things that I love, you know, farming, we're talking about heavy equipment, no-till and stuff. And a lot of us, you know, you'd mentioned about hand tools and doing stuff. And I know that on Proving Grounds too, you're going to be doing some stuff, more stuff with hand tools and stuff. Can you give any suggestions from seed management, planting management, residue management in this system with minimal tools and making it a success in the right is there any changes from to you to implement in that?
Yeah, that is a great question. I call them hide hills, little small plots on a ridge. You can't get a tractor to. I have a bunch of them. We probably should show more of what we do. So there's a couple of rules in any farming, gardening, whatever. One is real, it's real basic. Seed needs to make contact with the soil. So if you're using hand tools and you had a really thick fall crop, I mean, the deer ate it down, it got spring and it bolted because the deer eating native vegetation or in the neighbor's bean field or something. I mean, it's just dog hair thick. You walk through it broadcasting seed, a lot of the seed are not going to reach the soil. So you can do several things. You could use a herbicide. I choose not to. I tend to wait a little later and try to use a prescribed fire to remove much of that vegetation. Some is going to be green and it won't burn. And just take a rake or a backpack blower. And, you know, I've usually got timber around my food plots here. Just blow the leaves out away on the edge of the food plot. That's your fire break. I'm burning an eighth acre. I can do it by myself real safely. You know, I light it on where the wind's blowing. So it's just backing across there. Even an old man like me can run that quick and stay up with it. And when you burn, remember you're converting that top material to elements. The only thing going up in the air is nitrogen. The rest is falling to the ground. And there's 30 tons plus of nitrogen above every acre. We breathe it. We just got to convert it to something a plant can use. You should never pay for nitrogen. Plant some legumes. But if you burn it, it makes a beautiful seed bed. But then don't stop there. You got to wait till rain's coming, because if you broadcast your seed on that black surface and it's sunny out, you're going to roast those seeds before they ever germinate. And rain also, you know, raindrops falling about 30 miles an hour, it'll hit seed and help push it to the soil or splash a little dirt up on it, help cover it a little bit. So making sure seed hits the soil and you've got a rain coming real soon to germinate quick and grow is probably the best tip I can give anyone for using hand tools. There's no magic here. Just make sure that seed hits the soil.
I really appreciate that. We've talked a lot about the release process in this food plot system, and I think that really covers a really great point in pushing through this series of food plots. Again, I want to thank you for your time and your conversation. I got two questions for you real quick. So God has bestowed a beautiful gift on you, and you've got the opportunity to have the time and the resources to go on one adventure in creation. Where do you want to go? What do you want to do? Is that a hunt, or is that somewhere else? Or what would that be if you could pick a selfish trip in creation?
What timing? God must have divinely put that question in your mouth, because a good elk honeymoon is really expensive, right?
Yeah.
I love elk hunting. I just love being in the Rockies when the leaves are changing, elk are bugling, and stretch your legs out a little bit. I'm not a great elk hunter. I just love the experience. I have two daughters. Raleigh, who's 24, R-A-L-E-I-G-H, stands for Dweller by the Deer Meadow. Ray, R-A-E, 21, Hebrew for doe. God and deer impact everything in my life. God first, family second. And my daughters, let me cry. Want to go to Alaska for a salmon fishing trip this summer. Family outing. None of us ever caught a salmon in our life, right? Close we've been is a can of tuna or something like that. So I won't go on elk hunt. I will take my family salmon fishing this summer.
That's much. That is really, really cool. Thank you for sharing that. And the last question. So you've onto a new project with the Proving Grounds too. I'm kind of curious in this point in your career, like when you think, step back, like what is the biggest thing that you want to let your mark on something, what do you want that mark to be on your career and everything?
Well, I think my family is my legacy. Hopefully blessed that my kids are making way better choices at their age than I did at their age. I feel really passionate about improving soil health. I'm a deer biologist by training and heart. I feel very passionate about helping people understand, because if we improve soil health, we improve water cycles. This is all well proven, not theory. We improve air cycles, cleaner water, cleaner air. We have more nutrient packed food. A brief example, spinach right now on average has 40% less iron in it than just 10 or 20 years ago. because of depleted soils. So we have better human health. So if I can educate some people about improving soil health, I would feel that's a worthy life work.
I really like that. Hey, real quick, you know, most people that I think would listen to this have probably followed you and kind of know where to find you. But just real quick, plug everything you're doing where people can find you before we let you go.
Yeah, I'm not good at that. If you search whatever platform you're using for growing deer, you should find us. Just, you know, buzzword growing deer, what, you know, YouTube, our channel, social media, whatever, you're fine.
Gotcha. Dr. Woods, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you for the privilege. Thanks for being a great host. And I do hope our paths cross.